Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Rock Review. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about rock and roll music from such sources as the News and Observer, The Week Magazine, The Independent, New York Times, Rolling Stone, BGORecords.com, and Entertainment Weekly. This opening brought to us by The Ventures, their version of Sleigh Ride. We'll be hearing more from and about artists who did holiday rock later on in today's program, and they'll close it out as well. But first, these trivia questions. Our trivia questions come to us from www.brownielocks.com. Question number one, which Christmas carol was covered by Elvis Presley back in 1957? Big hint here, Gene Autry sang the original version 10 years before that, back in 1947. Question number two, what is the title of the Christmas song for which Nat King Cole is best remembered? Hint, this song was co-written by Mel Torme in 1944, and the title is sometimes mistakenly called by its subtitle. What is the real title of this song, sung by Nat King Cole back in 1950s? The transition section of today's program is brought to us once again by BGORecords.com. Today in rock history, and today is the weekend of Christmas, December 25 and December 26th. What were the number one hits this weekend? Back 45 years ago, it was the Beatles' Rubber Soul album at number one, and a little bit later than that, 1970, George Harrison's My Sweet Lord was at number one. And back in 1971, a year later this weekend, it was Melanie, Brand New Key, and back in 1993, it was Mariah Carey with Hero. If you were born on Christmas, December 25, you share a B-Day with Cab Calloway. He was born on that day back in 1907. Little Richard was also born on December 25, 1932. O'Kelly Isley of the Isley Brothers, born on December 25, 1937. Phil Spector, also born on December 25, 1940. Alice Cooper, December 25, 1945, Jimmy Buffett, 1946, on December 25th, and Annie Lennox, Eurythmics, born on December 25, 1954. If you were born on December 26, you share a birthday with Lars Ulrich from Metallica. He was born on that day back in 1963. Miscellany in rock history this weekend, well back 55 years ago, it was Bill Haley and the Comets releasing See You Later, Alligator. And back in 58, it was Alan Freed's Christmas Rock and Roll Spectacular opens a 10-day run in Manhattan with 17 acts, including Bo Diddley, Chuck Berry, Eddie Cochran, and Jackie Wilson. Also that same year this weekend, the Big Bopper enters the charts with Chantilly Lace. And back a year later after that, 1959, it was Richard Starkey, Ringo Starr, receiving his first drum set as a Christmas gift. The 18-year-old was working as an apprentice engineer at the time. And back in 1964, George Harrison's girlfriend, Patty Boyd, is attacked by jealous female fans at the Beatles' Christmas concert. And a year later, 1965, The Who entered the charts for the first time with My Generation. Finally, back in 1976, this weekend, it was the Eagles' sixth album, Hotel California, their first album with Joe Walsh, going platinum.
Bells will be ringing this sad, sad news. Oh, what a Christmas to have the blues. My baby's gone, I have no friends. wish me greeting once again. Choirs will be singing silent night.
The Eagles, Please Come Home for Christmas. In Rock News with a local connection, we see this article by Craig D. Lindsay from the News and Observer, published on the 10th of December, 2010, entitled, He's Got His Own Special Brand of Hollywood Cheer. John Waters loves Christmas. Seriously. You wouldn't expect the man behind such twisted cult classics as Pink Flamingos and Female Trouble and Polyester and his breakout Broadway musical-inspiring hit Hairspray to be the kind of guy who likes to deck the halls, but he swears he does. After spending most of this year promoting his last book of essays, Role Models, he just came back from Europe where he ran into Justin Bieber on a talk show and drew a facsimile of Walter's trademark thin mustache on Bieber's face. He says he's ready to celebrate the season. He has a Christmas party every year. He released a Christmas album, A John Waters Christmas, back in 2004. And he also has a touring one-man show of the same name, which made its debut December 15th at the Carolina Theater in Durham. Waters loves Christmas in his own alternative way. I always think it would be fun to break in someone's house and just move all their presents around and put the turkey back in the freezer, Waters says on the phone from his Baltimore home. But the idea of it, so the kids would think bad Santa came. See what we mean? The 64-year-old filmmaker will be dropping oddball nuggets like that during his show. I mean, I always have fantasies of taking the traditional Christmas and altering it in a way, he says. Not in real life, but certainly in my fantasies and in my writing and in my imagined scenarios, which is what I love to talk about at Christmas. Waters has been going from town to town talking about his love of Christmas for years now, dating back to the one-man shows he did in San Francisco after the release of his 1986 book, Crackpot, The Obsessions of John Waters, which included the essay, Why I Love Christmas. To make sure his Yuletide shtick never grows stale, Waters says he rewrites and reworks his heavily scripted show every year. But Waters always finds something worth riffing on, such as pondering that age-old quandary, is Santa erotic? Needless to say, this show isn't designed to be an experience for the whole family. Well, it depends on what family, Waters snarkily quips. It's not something you'd want to sit next to your mother and watch, unless she's very arty. The article skips down and ends with this. In the end, Waters feels he's doing a public service this time of year. I think I'm trying to tell everyone how to get through Christmas, whether you like it or hate it, he says. I'm trying to be a happy neurotic, and I think that's a very important thing to achieve when the holiday season is coming at you. This next article is brought to us by the Wall Street Journal, written by Terry Teachout, published on December 10, 2010, entitled The Man Who Said No to Hitler. His life was not in danger under the Nazis, but his soul was. He chose exile over a devil's bargain. Adolf Busch, spelled B-U-S-C-H, the greatest German violinist of the 20th century, is now known only to classical record collectors who treasure the searchingly eloquent 78s that he cut with Rudolf Serkin, his son-in-law and recital partner, and the Busch Quartet, the ensemble that he led for three decades. But there's another reason to remember him, one that in the long run may well count for as much as the music that he made. Mr. Busch's name is at the very top of the short list of German musicians who refused to kowtow to Adolf Hitler. This latter aspect of his life is described in detail in Tully Potter's Adolf Busch, The Life of an Honest Musician, the first full-length biography of the violinist ever to be published. It is at once a stirring tale and a disturbing one. Most of us, I suspect, like to think of artists as a breed apart, a cadre of idealists whose souls have been ennobled by long exposure to beauty. The truth, however, is that they are every bit as human as the rest of us, and that a certain number of them are self-centered opportunists who are perfectly willing to ignore evil, so long as the evildoers leave them in peace to do their work. That was pretty much what many German musicians did when the Nazis came to power back in 1933. Within a matter of days, Hitler and his henchmen started putting into place a policy of systematic persecution of German Jews. Numerous well-known Jewish musicians either were forced out of their post or quit in protest. In April, mere weeks after Hitler seized the levers of power, the Busch Quartet decided to stop playing in Germany. Mr. Busch also canceled his remaining recitals, issuing this statement: "Because of the impression made on me by the actions of my Christian compatriots against German Jews, I find it necessary to break off my concert tour in Germany. What makes this act so significant is that Mr. Busch was the only well-known non-Jewish German classical musician to emigrate from Germany solely as a matter of principle, and one of a bare handful of non-Jewish European musicians, including Arturo Toscanini and Pablo Casals, who resolved to stop performing there for the same reason. Virtually all of the other big names in Austro-German music, including Richard Strauss, stayed behind, some because they were active supporters of Hitler and others because they thought that the Nazi thing would dry up and blow away. Mr. Busch knew better. In a prophetic letter he wrote, some of them believe that if they only play along, the atrocities and injustice that are part and parcel of the movement will be tempered, can be turned around. Mr. Busch's principled stand was motivated in part by the fact that many of his closest friends and colleagues were Jewish. But the Nazis, who were keenly aware of the force of public opinion, were prepared to look the other way. In order to prevent a prominent non-Jewish Germans from leaving the country in protest. As late as 1937, it was discreetly made known to Mr. Busch that if he returned, the Nazi government would also allow his Jewish friends to come back as well. If you hang Hitler in the middle with Goering on the left and Goebbels on the right, I'll return to Germany, he replied. As anti-Semitic laws spread across the continent, Mr. Busch responded by canceling there as well, and at the end of 1939, he and the members of the Busch Quartet moved to the U.S. What happened next was a tragedy. Though Mr. Serkin was quickly able to establish himself as a top-tier soloist, America in the 1940s had an oversupply of famous violinists and a limited appetite for chamber music. Mr. Busch was able to eke out a living, but his days of fame were over. Moreover, he despaired over what had become of his beloved native land. As one recalled years later, he was so German that when that shame came, he felt responsible somehow. I think it would have been easier for him if he had been Jewish. He died a disappointed man. Do you find Mr. Busch's story inspiring? If so, then ask yourself this. How much would you be willing to inconvenience yourself over a matter of moral principle? Would you sign a petition? Help a friend who is being persecuted? Pull the plug on your career? Or would you simply put your head down and hope that your fellow countrymen would come to their senses sooner or later? Adolf Busch paid an awesomely high price for his beliefs. Of course, he did the right thing. But what would you do? Leah Greenblatt writes this next article, published in Entertainment Weekly on the 17th of December, 2010, entitled Grammy Watch, Snubs and Surprises, a critical look at the high points and low notes of this year's list of nominees, plus a few early predictions. The Grammy Awards announced the nominees for its 53rd annual ceremony on December 1, and as always, there were just enough anomalies to spark speculation and debate until the actual event airs on February 13th on CBS. The surprises: Katy Perry for Album of the Year? Justin Bieber for Best New Artist? After a long run of gray ponytailed traditionalism, this year's Grammy nominations seem to have brought the near total domination of the top 40. Bieber probably won't win Best New Artist. Canadian rock collective Arcade Fire are also long shots in another major category, Album of the Year. But it's a pleasure to see The Suburbs, a universally acclaimed record on a genuinely independent label, which, by the way, is Merge Records here in Durham, North Carolina, make the leap from the alternative category margins to the big kids' table, alongside Gaga, Eminem, and Lady Antebellum, as well as Perry, whose nomination for the manic incohesive Teenage Dream stands as one of the Academy's more confounding choices, The Snubs. Lady Gaga, the pop gale force powerful enough to instigate a change in the Grammy bylaws when she was deemed ineligible for last year's Best New Artist category, is oddly absent from both Song and Record of the Year slots. The former honors songwriting, the latter rewards performance and production. For her smash, Bad Romance. Sade's hypnotic comeback, Soldier of Love, was also denied any full album honors. As for Bruno Mars, his well-deserved 7 noms in categories ranging from Record and Song to Producer of the Year don't all come with top-line billing, but he may very well end up as the stealth MVP of the industry's starriest night. The nomination of so many young top 40 stars could be a trend. The 2010 awards telecast, for example, featuring a Taylor Swift gold rush and Lady Gaga-led performances, yielded the show's best ratings since 2004.
Because the last time you saw me, you still burned in the back of your mind. You gave me roses and I left them there to die.
Taylor Swift, Back to December, and this is, in fact, December 25th. And our genre today, Christmas rock songs, so what do you know about them? Well, you may remember that The Ventures opened today's program with Sleigh Ride, and this review by Editorial Review, Amazon.com, Michael Ruby says, this is Jingle Bell Rock the way it's supposed to be, with driving guitar, splashy drums, and full stereo separation. The Ventures' Christmas album just might be the best rock and roll holiday record ever made. The instrumental twang kings deliver pretty much what you'd expect. Note-for-note renditions of standards all dressed up with ubiquitous sleigh bells, as well as the requisite reverb. What really makes this disc a blast, though, is the way the quartet weaves 1960s pop signatures into every tune. For example, that opening number, Sleigh Ride, Walk Don't Run, were the guitar intro to that, and so on. Spin this and let your party guest have fun guessing which hit single will morph into a Christmas classic.
Rocking around the Christmas tree at the Christmas party hop. Mistletoe hung where you can see every couple tries to stop.
Although Decca released it in both 1958 and again in 1959, it did not sell well until Brenda Lee became a popular star in 1960. That Christmas season, it hit number 14 on the Billboard pop chart and turned into a perennial holiday favorite. It continued to sell well during the holiday season, hitting number 5 on the Christmas chart. Brenda Lee's recording still receives a great deal of airplay. Despite the song's title, its instrumentation also fits the country genre, which Brenda Lee more fully embraced as her career evolved. Despite her mature-sounding voice, she recorded this song when she was only 14 years old. This song has been performed by many, but Helms's version, it's Bobby Helms, is the most known in the world. Its title and some of its lyrics are takeoffs on the old Christmas standard Jingle Bells. It also makes brief references to other popular songs of the 50s, such as Rock Around the Clock, and mentions going to a jingle hop. An electric guitar played by Hank Garland can be heard playing the first notes to the chorus from the aforementioned Jingle Bells. Despite being titled a Jingle Bell Rock, Helms's version of the song was performed in the crossover style known as rockabilly, and to modern ears, it sounds a lot more country than it does rock and roll.
Pick up your feet, jingle around the clock, mix and mingle in the jingling feet. That's the Jingle Bell Rock.
Well, it's Christmas time again. There are very few of what I would consider to be Christmas classics that have been recorded in my lifetime. Mariah Carey's All I Want for Christmas Is You, off the top of my head, is one of the handful on the list, but Tom Petty's Christmas All Over Again, which you're hearing now in the background, definitely fits the bill. First appearing on the 1992 compilation, A Very Special Christmas 2, which was recorded to benefit the Special Olympics, the tune is one of the very best examples of rock and roll meets the holidays. Jingly, jangly, big chorus, and just as addicting as my grandmother's famous white cookies. And just like those cookies, it's a treat made that much sweeter by its appearance but once a year.
Yeah, I kind of missed them. I just don't want to kiss them, no.
And speaking of Mariah Carey, All I Want for Christmas Is You.
I don't want a lot for Christmas. There is just one thing I need. I don't care about the presents underneath the Christmas tree. I just want you for my own.
This is from her 1994 album, and music critics have universally praised the song. Kyle Anderson from MTV wrote a majestic anthem full of chimes, sleigh bells, doo-wop flourishes, sweeping strings, and one of the most dynamic and clean vocal performances of Carey's career. In his review, Thomas Connor from the Chicago Sun-Times called the song a simple, well-crafted chestnut and one of the last great additions to the Christmas pop canon. Editor of Scotland's The Herald, Shona Craven, wrote, "It's a song of optimism and joy that maybe, just maybe, hints at the real meaning of Christmas." Additionally, she felt the main reason it has become such a success is due to the "you" in its lyrics. Perhaps what makes the song such a huge hit is the fact that it's for absolutely everyone. And we'll be closing out today's program, appropriately, I believe, with Nat King Cole's The Christmas Song. But first, these reviews. This first review in contemporary rock music is brought to us by Entertainment Weekly, published on the 19th of November, 2010, and written by Tanner Stransky, and he's reviewing Glee, the music, the Christmas album. Though the disc sticks to the show's album formula, a gospel-fied ballad, Angels, We Have Heard on High, a pop fave, Last Christmas, a frothy mashup, Deck the Rooftop, it's still plenty joyful in that silly kids bop for adults way. The highlight, an unexpected take on Baby It's Cold Outside, sung by two dudes. Tanner Stransky gives it a B+, says download these, the head-turner tune, Baby It's Cold Outside, and the soaring Angels We Have Heard on High. This next review was published in The Week magazine, July 16, 2010, of the group called Sleigh Bells and their new album called Treats. Sleigh Bells is a band built around polarities, said John Pareles in the New York Times. The debut from this Brooklyn, New York-based boy-girl duo is a crackling, discordant mix of pop, rap, and rock that's at once harsh and sweet, dense and airy, flippant and serious, blatant and subtle. Treats can be an all-out blast, as long as you don't mind the head-wrecking collision of genres. Singer Alexis Krauss chirps hooks that could double as pep rally chants, while songwriter and producer Derek Miller transforms decades worth of funk, crunk, and guitar rock into hooks that don't just rock, they detonate. The duo's musical mergers manage to challenge basic assumptions of how music can and should sound, said Michael Saba in Paste. From the sampling of Funkadelic's Can You Get Into That in Real Real to the shatteringly loud catharsis of Sleigh Bells, bass beats and searing riffs of Infinity Guitars, Treats builds disparate sounds into a supremely raw and visceral pop masterwork. Once again, review of Sleigh Bells, the name of the group, and their album called Treats. And finally, this review, published in Entertainment Weekly on the 19th of November 2010, of Nora Jones and her album called Featuring. This was written by Greg Cott, and he gives it a B. And says, download these, the head-bobbing Q-tip team-up called Life is Better, and the hootenanny-worthy Dolly Parton duet called Creeping In. On this collection of 18 performances spanning her 9-year career, Nora Jones helps the Foo Fighters convert to bossa nova, reigns in outcast quirkiness, and smooths out the Dirty Dozen brass band's rough New Orleans edges. Elsewhere, Q-Tip brings out a hint of funkiness, Ray Charles nudges her to start bending notes, and Dolly Parton coaxes out her inner twang. A little friskiness suits her well. This being the last program of 2010, I have a couple quotes here. One is from Wall Street Journal, downloaded on the 10th of December 2010, and it's from Jim Fusilli on the year's best rock and pop music, looking back. Many of the best recordings seem to encapsulate the changes in popular music over the past few years. Genre mashing, cross-cultural communication, the reemergence of the singer-songwriter, and the joys of sophisticated chamber pop among them, while others took familiar traditions in new directions. 2010 has been the 25th anniversary of WFMT, that's World Federation of Music Therapy, and we end with a quote from Lao Tzu, and he said, music is in the soul can be heard by the universe. Music in the soul can be heard by the universe. So how'd you do on those trivia questions from today? Which Christmas carol was covered by Elvis Presley in 1957? And the hint I gave you was that Gene Autry sang the original version 10 years before that in 1947. That was Here Comes Santy, as Gene Autry would pronounce it, Claus. Here Comes Santy Claus. And the second question, what is the title of the Christmas song for which Nat King Cole is best remembered? The hint I gave you here was that this song was co-written by Mel Torme in 1944, and the title is sometimes mistakenly called by its subtitle, but the title is The Christmas Song. Speaking of which,
chestnuts roasting on an open fire, Jack Frost nipping at your nose.
Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Rock Review. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long until next time. Happy New Year and Merry Christmas.
Tiny tots